Hello and welcome to another edition of the Sport Intern Special, a series of podcasts in which we speak to the movers and shakers within the Olympic movement. Now in this edition, we chat to Janice Burke. Janice is the CEO of Harris County Euston Sport Authority and is a woman that led the charge to the city of Euston successfully being able to host matches in the upcoming FIFA World Cup in 2026. The next World Cup will be hosted by three countries, the USA, Mexico and Canada, and the city of Euston will be hosting up to six matches. And Janice began her conversation by telling me she was proud because it was the first time that the city was going to be hosting World Cup matches.
Houston was not part of the World Cup the last time it was in the United States. So for me, leading into it for about a decade, we've been very conscious of that, trying to book whatever international friendlies or Copa America, Gold Cups, small events, big events. We really put a focus on it to show the world that we are this great soccer town. Of course, back then we didn't have a professional soccer stadium or a team either, but we just wanted to make sure that we had our place at the table. And so it was actually relieving when they announced Houston after spending so much time and effort towards getting that bid.
Well, why was it so important for you? I mean, what was so key in sort of positioning yourself where you are now?
I think it's key because it's the world's largest sporting event, right? I mean, the viewership is off the charts compared to anything else. Some could argue that the Olympics and that is a very big event as well. But for our purposes, I think Houston really needed to win it. Again, because of all of the big events we do and the big events, we needed our community to be proud of our efforts and to feel like they're a part of the World Cup.
I mean, we've had, I think this will be now the third edition of the World Cup being hosted by the US. And yet, although there is a lot of fans, it just doesn't really break that barrier. How do you see that relationship?
I think it's changing, though, at least in our city. We're a very international city. And so as kids have grown up with soccer and moms and dads have learned the soccer rules because they've been out there watching their kids, I think you do see that shift. The excitement has been off the charts here. So everywhere we go, what the announcement was, I don't know, 8 months ago, and people are still on a high. So I think that there is, you do see some movement. The last time they were in the United States, I was on the hotel side. I was a team hotel. And I think, I don't even remember going to the games. I don't remember all the hoopla around it. Maybe I was so focused on taking care of the team inside the hotel, but I don't remember the kind of excitement that you feel now. So hopefully the United States will catch up with the rest of the world.
Talk us through a little bit, because it's a very privileged position for us to speak to someone who really knows and understands and puts together a bidding process. Talk us through what that has been like. What were the complexities, the more interesting or the most complicated, difficult parts of the whole thing?
Yes, I think a lot of people wonder, how do these mega events land in a city, whether it's a Final Four or a college football playoffs like we have next year? Do they just like a city and so they pick it? And I don't think the common person who's not involved in our sports industry understands what a dogfight it is, right? Every city wants to put these mega major events on, and every city wants to be able to host, not only because of the positive economic impact it brings, but it's also a way for your citizens to feel proud and to feel a part of something bigger than their normal sports scene. And there's a lot of legacy items to it and a halo effect that happens long after the event comes and goes. So for that reason, there is a big competition out there. Our strategy is different depending on who's making the decision. Sometimes it's a world championship where every country has a vote. Sometimes it's an executive committee. With the NCAA, it's a basketball committee, right? So it's always a little bit different depending on who we think that final decision maker is and who the influencers are to that decision maker.
In your case, was it a very united front? Let's go for this. Let's put ever, you know, all our eggs in one basket and see if we can pull it off and get some matches. Or did you have to fight and convince people, perhaps within your own committee that you work with?
No, I think it was pretty united. We knew it was a big enough event that we needed to put all our efforts towards it. I think we knew we were on the cusp, unlike some other cities that maybe felt a little bit more comfortable with their positioning. We hired Chris Canetti, who was the president of our MLS team here in Houston, and said, look, we need somebody focusing every single day. I have all these other events, and we're a public entity with public board meetings, and we're the landlords to the team. So there's a lot of other things on my plate. And I knew that this needed the attention of somebody who came from the soccer side of things, who had a passion for it, but also could wake up every single day just thinking about it. And so he helped us bring it to the finish line when we made it into, you know, the original bid. That was exciting. There was a big celebration, but then we knew that it was going to be cut. Those U.S. cities would still be cut down and some U.S. cities would be left out. And so our strategy was, let's raise some dollars, let's raise some awareness, let's also tell the world our story. We were really interested in talking to the international world because, again, to influence the decision makers, they needed to know who we were and they needed to know of our successes. And so we had a little bit different strategy maybe than some of the other US cities.
And what was it that you had identified early on that FIFA would be looking for in terms of hosting the matches to the cities? And in that criteria that you had identified that you needed to satisfy FIFA with, what were the advantages that you had over other cities?
I think it's a difficult bid process. There are many things that are not part of the normal bid process. For instance, all the sustainability and human trafficking, anti-human trafficking, I should say, issues that they wanted you to address. On top of things like in America, our sponsors who, let's just take energy, for instance, our stadium's called Energy Stadium and our sponsors paid millions of dollars for that. But during World Cup, it's not called Energy Stadium, it's called World Cup Stadium. And so being able to go through and make sure you had the buy-in of the entire community, even sponsors that have paid a lot of money to have their name on a building. So it's a lot of things behind the scenes like that. The grass growing, you know, think about it. We're crossing three countries with lots of different climates. Some of our stadiums have roofs, some do not. It's a very precarious thing, right? To make sure that the grass plays the same so that there's fair play for all the teams, no matter what stadium they're in. And so there were a lot of discussions about grass and how we were going to grow the grass and root the grass in our stadium. And we have a very, very important event. It's called the Houston Livestock Show and Rodeo. Sorry, I don't mean to be stumbling on my words, but it's been here for, you know, many, many years. It's never ever canceled. It always happens at the same time of year. It's part of the fabric of Houston. And so we couldn't start growing grass as early as some of the other stadiums. So we had to overcome that. We had to figure out, well, how do we ensure that the grass and the pitch, which is so important, is going to still be fine, even though we can't start loading in and growing the grass until after the rodeo.
What about the costing for this? I mean, how much of it has, if you don't have the figures, maybe even as an idea of percentage, how much of it is public funding and how much of it is coming in from private equity that you guys have raised?
So we're really lucky in the state of Texas. We have what's called the Major Events Reimbursement Program. And with that program, it was designed actually during some years when San Antonio was bidding for the Pan Am Games, and the Pan Am Games needed government assurance that dollars would be set aside. And there really was no way to do that. And so through that process, they didn't win the bid, but they won a lot for the state of Texas because we were able to get this program. And what it is, is you do an economic impact study and show the state how many taxes are going to come in or projected taxes through that event that is a windfall for the state. And the state, in return, will share some of that back with the local community that is paying for the event. And so we use those dollars to help pay for it. And so there is a big portion of our budget that will be public funded. We will still have to go out and raise dollars, just like every other city, but we have a much lighter lift than some cities. And then the other thing, because there's two of us, so there's Dallas and Houston, and the state will have never paid this amount of dollars out ever before. One of our strategies was let's support Dallas, and Dallas did the same. They supported Houston, and let's talk about how easy it will be for people to get from one city to the next that want to maybe visit Mexico, Houston, Dallas, and that it could be a good thing to give to cities in the state of Texas. Because in the early days, some people said, well, they'll just never give one state to award two cities. And so I think for us, from the very beginning, we wanted to support Dallas, they wanted to support us. And we do think that movement between the two cities will be actually good for both of us.
And what about the general public at large? I pick up on you saying that there was a lot of excitement, still is, but when you have so many costs, and perhaps, as you say, soccer is still breaking through that, did you have to try and convince some people and say, well, yes, that money could have been spent in other areas, developing more traditional sports? What kind of reaction have you had from people on the street?
Yeah, I think there's always concern by certain people that are very conservative and say, well, how are you going to raise this money? And is it worth it? What are we displacing? And what does it mean if our city passed on this? So I'm always very open to have those conversations. We bid for events for a variety of reasons. Like I said, some of it is the legacy that it's going to leave well beyond the event. And that's important to us. We did have some people, question, and I'm really glad for people to question that, because then it helps us to sharpen our pencil too, and to make sure this really truly is the best thing for us to be spending our money on.
And what about the legacy? That's always the buzzword, isn't it? Whether you get it from the International Olympic Committee, FIFA, whoever it is. What is the legacy in terms of what you will leave for the city, but also, I suppose, in terms of the future development of the sport and what happens with it?
Yeah, it's a good question, because I think sometimes that word is overused. People are a little bit maybe tired of it. And so I kind of use that, the phrase halo effect as well. But for sure, in our country, or at least our city, I'll take our city because I can speak to it, soccer is not as accessible to inner city kids as it is to the kids in the suburbs. And it's still very much a pay to play type of sport. And we need, especially in our city where we're so international, and we have so many kids that are interested in soccer and want to play soccer, we need to break down those barriers. And that barrier of entry is something we're focused on. And we hope that one of our legacy items is providing more opportunity for kids to play soccer that want to.
You bring me in quite nicely with referring there to breaking down barriers, because that's certainly something that you've been doing. There aren't that many women in such a high position in sports administration and CEOs of big setups like this. Can you share us a little bit about your path to getting where you are today?
Sure. I started in the hospitality industry, and we always touched sports because our hotel where it was located is back in the Pontiac Silverdome days. If you remember that, when World Cup was here, they played there. And so we had professional football team, professional basketball players. And then on the weekends, we were very much a corporate hotel during the week. And on the weekends, we had all these amateur sporting events. And so I learned early on that sports was a market that any city could do, large or small, because if you've got golf courses or you've got space for volleyball nets to be put up, or you have roads that marathon runners can run on, everybody can do sports. You just have to figure out, no matter how big or small you are, what is your forte and what can you put on. And so As I moved around the country, after I left the hotel side, I worked for convention visitor bureaus and really was similar. You're still in the hospitality space and still serving people and still branding and marketing your product, but it's just a much larger product because now you're selling a county or a region. In my case, it was three counties. And then as I was recruited and moved around the country, helping cities brand and market themselves, I always kept a little piece of that sports side of things because I feel like sports is a great unifier. And it's a really good way, like I said, when small communities as well as large are trying to work together. And my first CEO job, it was over a five county region, a really vast geographic space, and they were very different. So you had a more of a downtown capital city, then you had a very rural areas. And so I felt like sports was one area that everybody could partake in. And so I've always kind of kept that. This is my first time in Houston of doing just sports. But I think that sports has a way of, I guess, bringing all different kinds of backgrounds together. And I look at even when we won the World Series, our Astros team, and you've got all of these people who are perfect strangers, high-fiving each other, yelling across the street, singing together. Nothing like sports brings a community together.
Did you feel that you were fighting certain barriers or certain prejudices, perhaps people saying, yeah, but you know, she's a woman. Can she really be in charge of a bid for the World Cup? You know, it's such a big event coming up.
Yes, I think sometimes, you know, it's not that men are trying to be rude. They just don't really know. Am I supposed to slap her on the back and say, let's go have a beer? Or am I supposed to open the door for her? Right. And so I think the more that you can just be real and have real relationships, that all those barriers kind of go away, as long as you know your stuff and you're working hard. And I've had a lot of men that have been mentors and have been great cheerleaders. But I've had men that have also stood in my way, but I've had the same on the women's side. So I think as women, we need to just brush yourself off and learn to live with those defeats and just push through. And if it is somebody is standing in the way as a roadblock, then figure out how to go around it.
Well, that was Janice Burke, the CEO of Harris County Houston Sport Authority. Don't forget, you can catch up with all the latest in the world of sport by subscribing to the Sport Intern newsletter, produced every day, Monday to Friday. So until next time, stay safe.